Welcome to the Tipsy Archives. I'm your host, Rachel Leagy. You may have noticed that I've added a bit of music to the intro, so I'm excited about that. And I'm also testing out a new microphone on this episode. So if you want to let me know what you think, please do. You can get a hold of us either on the email. I will say it again at the end of the podcast, like I usually do. But it is thetipsyarchives@gmail.com. And if you're not following us already on Twitter, you can find us at Tipsy Archives. So please come follow us and also give us your feedback and let us know what you think. On this episode, I was joined by my friend Michael Elliott, and he told me all about one of his favorite historical figures, Socrates. We discussed his life, his trial, and how his death contributed to the birth of Western philosophy. I learned a lot, so I hope you do too. Please enjoy. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Welcome to my podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You are a writer and a villain and also my dungeon master.
All true, yes.
Yeah. And I asked you to come on and hang out with me today. And when I asked you what you wanted to talk about, you definitely wanted to talk about Socrates.
I did. He is my favorite philosopher. I studied philosophy in university at SFU, and then I changed majors like you do. Well, sort of. I did a lot of religious studies later, and kind of had like a double degree in both those fields. But yeah, I really gravitated mostly towards the Greeks, Socrates, Plato, and ones that came before and after, and Socrates is hands down my favorite philosopher. So you wanted me to talk about something that's interesting and historic and somewhat full of scandal.
Yeah, I always want my guests to, you know, bring me something that they can sink their teeth into. And you definitely have me at a bit of a disadvantage because this is a field that I know, like, so little about other than the representations I've seen in art as I've been studying art history. So I did do a little bit of research here, but why don't I let you tell me a bit about, let's start with what's going on in Athens, because this is where Socrates is from.
It's true. We are in the, around the year 399 BC, which is the first century. I never remember how to count backwards from that.
Oh, I was thinking about that today, the whole like BCE thing, and I'm thinking, oh, so he was born in, is it the late or the early?
I've never been a fan of this convention we've established of counting backwards from zero at a very arbitrary point, but that's probably a different podcast, I'd imagine.
Yeah, but we can say he was, this is around, sorry, you just said,
about 399 BC was his trial.
His trial.
Subsequent death.
Which is what we are going to talk about.
Indeed. Yeah, first, Athens. We kind of need to know what's happening, what life is like, before we realize how important Socrates was and why he eventually got put on trial for the stuff he did. So, to start, Athens and the neighboring city-state of Sparta, some of the two kind of power players in ancient Greece, just finished a very long, bloody war, the Peloponnesian War.
So is this before or after Gerard Butler is wearing really strappy sandals and very little clothing?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think this might be, because I know the Persian Empire was up and going at this point as well, but I'm not entirely sure if this was before or after.
I mostly just wanted to make a 300 reference.
Well, congratulations. But you're setting the correct kind of stage. Very, very cut men in not much clothing in the Mediterranean heat. But yes, the Athenians just lost kind of embarrassingly to Sparta. And as a consequence of that, the Spartans establish an oligarchical government in Athens to strip away their democracy. called the 30 Tyrants, who, based on the name, are not incredibly well liked. They executed a lot of people, they confiscated a lot of property, they exiled several prominent people that were Democrats, that were, you know, the biggest fans of democracy in the city.
And the Greeks are the ones who invented democracy.
Yes, as far as I know. At least a version that we still kind of use today.
Yeah.
Theirs was more direct, where all the, you know, free people that owned land got to vote on basically kind of everything directly, whereas we use representatives, but it is, yeah, it is very similar. But these 30 tyrants they rule Athens for about 13 months before they get ousted because everyone hates them. They, as you can imagine, they're killing people, they are taking land. Eventually the populace just has enough of them, and so they leave. But they're led by a man named Critias, at least that's one of the leaders, and that'll be important later on when we talk about Socrates.
Okay.
So Athens is just getting out of this huge war, they've just ousted the tyrants, there's a lot of hurt feelings, like their pride's been hurt. They are trying to rebuild their democracy. They're trying to get back to what it means to be Athenians, trying to get back to core values in a lot of ways. And one of those is the role of the gods in ancient Greek life. So they're very kind of, I guess it's prescriptive. You made sacrifices to the gods all the time, usually just burning bits of animal or something to get good favor if you're going on a trip or if you're hosting a party.
And, of course, Athens, city of Athena.
Exactly. The gods are part of everyone's daily life.
Yeah.
There are shrines everywhere. They take the gods seriously. They're kind of the relatable, crazy royal family that's always watching you.
Right.
Anyone who's read, you know, Homer or any of the Greek myths, the gods are just as weird and complicated as we are, but they can also cause storms and your crops to fail. So it's important to be on their good side. And they valued the things that they imagined the gods valued based on, you know, Homeric stories. So to be successful, to have the good virtues of courage, wisdom, temperance, to be fair and just, which in their definition is something called lex talionis, which means you repay good with good and evil with evil. So if someone slaps you, you should slap them back. That is what is just and fair. If someone gives you something, you should give them something.
So I was doing some research, and I mean, was it also correct? It seemed that in this society, people do also value, like now, being rich and successful and having fame and that kind of thing, too.
Definitely.
Which I think kind of comes into some things that are important to Socrates later.
Absolutely, yes. So one more thing that's important to our story are these people that start popping up in Athens around this time. They didn't really exist before, called sophists, which comes from the Greek word sophos, meaning wise man.
I just want to point out that we're drinking wine called Wise Owl that I picked out because it had the word wise in it.
It's very fitting.
Yes.
I'm quite enjoying it.
It's good, actually. Yeah. I like it.
So these guys are, they're kind of the first lawyers. They make a living by teaching rhetoric, specifically usually to rich and powerful people who are involved in lawsuits or in the courts, which is, again, a large part of Athenian life. Like, if you wanted to worship different gods or something, there was people you go to and say, hey, we want to petition the court to introduce these rites, and they'd say yes or no. It was a very bureaucratic kind of life, and there were a lot of, you know, lawsuits happening, stuff like that.
So at this time, I mean, are philosophers a thing, or is this sort of
not,
they become a thing?
This is kind of where they start becoming a thing. Right. Like, the sophists are part of the first kind of philosophical movement in the Western tradition.
Gotcha.
So before, we have people like Thales and Aristarchus and Anaximander who were,
I'm impressed that you can remember those names.
Well, that's, you know, that's 4 years of philosophy in university. That's the only time I get to flex those muscles when I'm drinking with friends, basically. Get to show off a bit. But yeah, philosophy at this point was mostly just wondering what stuff is made of.
Right.
So, for example, Thales thought everything was made out of water in different forms, and then we thought it was soupy abstract stuff called apeiron, and then it was wind, and then it was the four elements, and then it eventually became atoms, and that sort of settled the debate for a while.
It kind of reminds me of, and this is, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of years later, but, like, I have a little bit more knowledge in medieval studies, and so, of course, like, Greeks and Romans get a bunch of stuff right. People forget about it for a long time. And then, you know, in medieval times, people go back to being like, what are we made out of? Black goo, maybe?
Exactly.
Smoke? Good intentions? I don't know. Like, it's funny what people think universe is made of.
Exactly. And it's especially interesting with some of the later Greeks, because I'm sure you know Aristotle and Plato kind of get picked up again in the medieval era and talking about Christian theology and stuff like that. They reference some of those ideas that kind of get started in this period. So yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Cycles.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, so we have these sophists, and they kind of get piled into what people consider philosophers, because at their base, they're a bunch of old men who are arguing about things in the streets.
Right.
But except the sophists are doing this for money.
I see a lot of those men on commercial drive. Yeah. Sitting in front of Italian coffee shops.
Again, the more things change, the same. Yeah. So, yeah, they make a living creating arguments for people, training people in the art of argument and rhetoric to defend themselves in court. Mm. But these guys don't have, like, they're lawyers in the very stereotypical sense, whereas you kind of imagine lawyers these days as being, you know, very rich and not really caring about what the truth is, just how well they can bullshit their side. And these are, from what we've been told, very much in that cloth. They don't really care what is true, what Athenians traditionally value. They just want their clients to be able to argue that I didn't steal this horse, or I'm not guilty of this particular crime. So there's a lot of, they start introducing a lot of moral relativism into Athenian society, and some of these people are arguing a lot more about what is true. And this, at this time, remember when Athens just got their ass handed to them by the Spartans, isn't doing a lot for people's collective morale.
Like, yeah, there's a lot of bitterness.
Exactly. They want to believe in the gods. They want to believe that they're keeping them safe, that they haven't been abandoned.
And there are also probably a lot of people with self-interest just wanting to survive.
Exactly. Secure their fortunes, live their lives. Now we're kind of got the stage set for this guy called Socrates.
Right.
So, before we even talk about his philosophy, it's important, I think, to understand, going forward, Socrates is really weird in a lot of ways. Like, starting out, he is kind of a typical Athenian. Like, he has a family, he owns a bit of land, he served in the army, he kind of, like, distinguished himself in the Peloponnesian War. But he spends a lot of time asking people questions all the time. Like, he will, and they're weird abstract questions. Like, he'll ask artists, how do they know the thing they're making is beautiful? And he'll argue day and night about it.
So does he gets to a point in his life where he just decides he's not going to work anymore?
Yeah.
And he's just going to wander around.
Exactly.
In dirty clothes.
Yeah, his clothes are always dirty. He's very rarely wearing shoes. He's disheveled. He's also notably ugly, which we were talking about.
Yeah, that. So one of the problems with Socrates is there are no primary sources.
Exactly.
He either didn't write anything down or nothing survived.
It's more likely he didn't write anything down because we're, and this is actually also kind of important, we're just getting out of the oral tradition of storytelling. Like, Plato, I'm pretty sure it was Plato who kind of famously said that he didn't trust writing. He didn't like it because he thought it was going to shorten people's memories. And then, of course, he became a very prolific writer. But
like druids.
Yeah.
So there's no primary sources. All we have are basically secondary stories that aren't necessarily histories, but almost more like anecdotes and teachings talking about him. But there's two things that all these writings can agree on, even though they vary in other ways. One is that he's brilliant, and the second is that he's ugly.
Yeah. I have a bust of Socrates that I actually picked up in England in a very small town in like this thrift shop. It was a very weird find, but I latched onto it because it is this great depiction. He has he kind of looks like a pug.
Yeah, I think I've seen
like a very like snubbed nose.
That
very
bust comes up in basically every article.
Exactly, buggy eyes. They're too far apart. He's bald. Or balding, I think.
So you're a sculptor or something on the street, and this guy comes up to you, dirty, with this, like, smushed-in face, asking you questions. You're like, exactly. Dude, please leave me alone.
If you can imagine, like, I want to try to make people appreciate how weird this was and how in everyone's face he was getting.
Mm-hmm.
And the closest, like, analogy I can give is, like, so imagine Twitter. It's a forum where pretty much anyone can go and spout their opinion and get in exchanges with other people. Right now it's a very kind of awful, dark place. But that kind of public forum existed a lot in Athens. Like there was lots of public markets and people would often get together, see plays and hold debates. And like the art of rhetoric, as was popularized by the Sophists, was becoming theater. So it wasn't odd for groups of people to kind of get locked in debates in the middle of markets and for people to watch and emulate what they saw.
Unlike now where people get together in squares because there's a poke lore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
it's a little more social than that.
Yeah, it is. So if you can imagine a much like accessible, less nasty version of Twitter that existed where everyone can kind of talk and exchange ideas and weren't awful perpetually. And then this guy with a handle at Socrates comes around, and he starts asking all these people who think they know, who purport to know a lot. So imagine you get this guy starts talking to, let's say, a famous scientist like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's known a lot about astronomy, and starts asking him fundamental questions about astronomy that you would assume some guy like Neil deGrasse Tyson would be able to answer. And over the course of this debate, Socrates gets him in all these paradoxical knots. And eventually you begin to realize that Neil deGrasse Tyson doesn't really know what he's talking about.
I've always wondered that about him.
Which I'm sure is not actually true in Neil deGrasse Tyson's taste, but to illustrate the point I'm trying to make. And he does this, everyone does this with politicians, he does this with artists, he does this with poets, anyone who purports to think they know something, especially about the virtues of what is just, of what is wise, of what these big ideas are about. He takes them all to task in very public ways and exposes them as not really knowing anything by tripping them up in all this rhetoric and logical fallacies that are the same kind of thing that the Sophists do.
Hmm.
Except Socrates isn't making any money.
Right.
He is poor. As you said, like the dialogues all kind of agree that he had barely any money, he had a bad relationship with his family.
Yeah. His wife's name is Xanadu. No, it's not. It's Xanthippe.
Xanthippe.
Yeah, I want it to be Xanadu.
It's an equally ridiculous name. Yeah. I'll give you that.
But yeah, he's not really taking care of those guys.
Yeah. Another way to kind of illustrate this, I read this brilliant novel recently called The Just City by Joe Walton, which I highly recommend if you're interested in Greek philosophy or philosophy of any kind. It's a... She imagines that the Greek gods are the real gods, and some of them come together. I think it's Athena and Apollo, and they say that they want to make Plato's Republic a real thing. Athena knows about this island that's going to be destroyed by a volcano eventually, so let me know historical record. They want to get great thinkers from throughout history together and see if Plato's Republic, his supposed utopia, could work. And it all goes similarly, but then they eventually get Socrates into the mix. And it all falls apart. It's a brilliant book.
He just picks everyone apart?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And she does a great job of illustrating one of the kind of cores of why he was questioning people. And it's something he asks his students and asks people constantly, which is the question, do you know that, or were you told that?
That's a really good question.
Right, because a lot of our knowledge comes from, indeed in this case, secondhand sources.
Yeah.
We trust experts that tell us things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very rarely that we actually figure something out on our own.
Mm-hmm.
and know it to be true that way. So that's what he was getting at. He didn't like people.
There's only so few things you can learn from experience.
That's a good point. But in an era where a lot of people were peddling knowledge because they just thought they could get away with it, that right. really irked Socrates. Knowledge was something that was very important to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he believed it, similarly to the way that, I mean, his core beliefs weren't that different from most Athenians. He believed in the importance of the virtues. He believed in the gods, despite what we're going to see soon in the trial. But he didn't think that these were just acquired through good deeds or wealth or renown. He believed that every virtue was a kind of, like, craft knowledge. You got better by doing it. And the way you get better at the virtues is you do philosophy. You question them. You hold up different examples. You describe, okay, is this act just or not? Why is it just or not? And by asking this never-ending series of questions, almost like, you know, a 3 or 4 year old who figured out what why means,
mm-hmm.
can annoy you with that.
My nephew is at that stage right now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is very annoying, isn't it?
It's annoying, but I kind of try to make it a point to do my best to answer all of his whys mm-hmm. with actual answers, just because it's almost like an exercise.
Definitely, and that is the kind of thing that Socrates would have loved. He wants to know where the questions stop.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he's the guy who we get that, you know yourself, examine your life, or mm-hmm. what is it, an unexamined life is not worth living, or something along those lines.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he thought that by philosophy you could study the virtues, and that could lead you to becoming happy, and that wasn't in wealth or skills or being the Homeric ideal of a man. It was about philosophy. It was about questioning everything you knew until you knew what things were true.
So, funny side story. When I was, I think, 18 years old, I broke up with my first boyfriend. And I remember the moment I knew our relationship was over. I said something about wanting to get a book or learn something. And he's made a comment about how he thought he was probably the person he was going to be and he didn't have anything else to learn.
Wow.
And he was 20 years old. And in my brain, I thought, okay, goodbye. Always be learning.
Wow, yeah. I mean, that was...
Maybe he was just trying to disagree with me, but...
I guess. I mean, I was a pretty shitty teenager, but I can't imagine mm-hmm. wanting to do that.
No, I mean, I really enjoyed researching all of this stuff because if anybody asked me what's the most important thing to you, basically at any time in my life, like, I would pretty readily answer knowledge. You know, over, love or
mm-hmm.
power or whatever, because I do consider learning to be probably the most important thing in my life over anything else.
Definitely. Yeah, I think Socrates would definitely agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Socrates is making a name for himself in Athens as being this guy who is very wise because he seems to know more about anything than anyone else.
Yeah.
Even though what he's really doing is just exposing how little other people know.
Right.
And so this is where we can talk about the story of the Oracle of Delphi.
Right.
Just kind of Socrates' onus to really double down on being a real asshole to everyone he meets.
Mm-hmm. This is a very pivotal moment in his life.
Exactly. Because Socrates is a very devout man. He believes in the gods. He probably doesn't believe in them the same way that most Athenians do, but that's... I had one of my professors in my philosophy courses was actually a kind of expert on Socrates. Like, he studied it, but we read a bunch of his books. He talked a lot specifically about the religion of Socrates and is interesting and very nuanced and goes into a lot of Greek, and it's beyond the scope of this podcast, but suffice to say, he believe the gods existed, and the oracles at Delphi were kind of one of the ways you spoke to the gods, or how they gave advice, basically. You had mm-hmm. these...
They believed Delphi to be the navel of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you had these people who would deliver prophecies and divinations, who were might have been high on fumes coming out of the ground. And one of his students, one of his friends, goes to these oracles to say, is there anyone wiser than Socrates? to which the oracle replies, no. So the student comes back to Socrates, gives him this amazing news, and Socrates is flummoxed. He's actually kind of disappointed.
No kidding.
Because he doesn't think he's very wise at all. He has spent most of his life asking questions and not getting very many answers. And so he starts trying to... part of the reason why he's questioning all these people who purport to know a lot about justice and beauty and love is because he wants to find the person to prove the oracle wrong and say, no, this is a big mistake. I'm not the wisest person, which being one of the cardinal virtues that Athenians kind of worship is kind of also a big deal. He wants to find someone who can be an example that, you know, this person actually knows more than I do.
So, and by doing so, he's questioning the gods.
In a way.
Or at least challenging them
a bit. I think he just wants... Yeah, but, yeah, actually, you're right. I think that maybe he didn't think it was completely true. Maybe he wanted to get to the bottom of why they said that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I say that because he eventually concludes that the oracle was right because he was the only one willing to admit that he didn't know anything. In a city full of supposed experts, he was the one guy who said, I don't know what I'm doing.
And concluded that that did, in fact, make him wise.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know that I know nothing.
Okay. So, how does this start to piss people off?
Well, in the first way, it is exposing people who are experts, like the sophists, and showing they don't know anything, which has immediate financial cost to them. It is also, a lot of the times this happens in public places in front of his students and other people, and so he is publicly embarrassing people. And when you get a great poet to admit in a weird way that he doesn't know anything about poetry, that's also going to divert business away.
And this is a city of people who are currently very sensitive.
Exactly. They're already kind of pissed off in several ways. And he starts teaching other people to do what he's doing, or they start emulating him, basically, because this is a popular thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't, you know, there's theater, but, like, to have a good night out in Athens is to watch a wise man dismantle someone else's argument. Courts were like that. They were very, like, weirdly participatory, where people would shout and, I mean, there was the courts, which we'll see, like, had hundreds of jurors in them. They were very back and forth. But, so yeah, he starts teaching younger people to do this. And that starts pissing off their parents because what do you imagine a teenager, young person does when they realize they get to dismantle all their parents' bullshit arguments about why they're in charge?
I'm sure it went over well.
It did not. So,
I just had a flashback to my own teenage years. I'm like, right? That sounds a little bit like something I would have been doing.
Me too. So yeah, he's pissing off people in general, he's pissing off the people who are in power, and he's also vaguely talking about the fact that he has this personal demon, that he has this spirit that kind of talks to him sometimes. And it's never...
Right, but does he has this theory that everyone has one of these, or is it just him?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I want to say that he assumes most people do, and he just listens to his. For him, it was more just kind of a conscience. Like, it didn't tell him to do things.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah. Is this, like, does he really believe it's a being outer of his body, or is it just an internal... Oh, he does. It's not just an internal voice.
He believes it is a spirit of the gods sent to make sure he doesn't do anything wrong. That he doesn't enter public office. That it kind of just points him away from things that might be dangerous. Which he views as kind of, perhaps it was emanation from Athena or something, but in the way he describes it in the trial, he very much believes it is one of the spirits of the gods, or like a servant of the gods that is helping him through these things. And he does remark on that to his students and to people.
And this freaks people out.
Kind of does.
Yeah,
because you don't often, I mean, it would be about as weird as if you had someone around for dinner and they say an angel gives them advice sometimes. Like you'd look twice, probably.
You'd begin to worry about them.
Maybe, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be fair. So, and he's also getting lumped in with the sophists. Because like them, he is questioning everything. He is, there's a popular phrase that comes up a lot in the trial. He's making the weaker argument defeat the stronger. And he gets lampooned in this famous play called The Clouds by Aristophanes, where this character Socrates runs a school of sophists. And this kid comes in because his dad wants his kid to learn how to argue so he can get out of this gambling debt he owes, or I think it was something involving a horse. And the son turns on his father and beats him, and then argues and convinces his father that it is right for the son to beat the father when they're wrong. And so this whole thing is lampooning the sophists and how ridiculous they are, and that they can twist Athenian values in this way.
But Socrates isn't lumping himself in with the sophists.
No.
No.
But everyone else is.
Hmm.
And everyone else doesn't really like the sophists to begin with. So, one day, these three guys, Miletus, Anytus, and Lycon, representing poets, politicians, and sophists, respectively, in the city, file an injunction against Socrates in the court and force him to appear. Basically, they lay charges.
So what do they charge him with?
There are three charges. That Socrates does not recognize the gods recognized by the state. This first one is huge. It is, in a roundabout way, saying he's an atheist, which is a capital kind of offense.
Right.
Like, this would be a huge trial these days with, like, 24-hour news coverage. Like, this
is basically the O.J. Simpson trial of ancient Greek times.
Yes. This was a really big deal.
Gotcha.
And Socrates was already a very public figure, so this was huge. The second charge is that Socrates introduces new divinities, which one of the notes I had from my classes when I was reviewing for this says that this is the first time in the history of Athens that this charge has been leveled against anybody.
Hmm.
It's already another very historic moment. And finally, that Socrates corrupts the youth, or that he teaches the youth the things outlined above. That he's introducing new deities, and that he does not recognize the gods as the state recognizes them. So basically leading the youth into ruin is what they're trying to say.
Gotcha.
So these are the charges. Socrates comes out, and like I said, the jury is 500 or probably 501 people, so it's not even. And, you know, Socrates' friends and family there. The place is packed. These courtrooms are huge. And instead of hiring a lawyer or someone else, Socrates speaks for himself.
Of course he does.
And he immediately starts questioning his accusers, which you don't do in court.
So he puts them on trial.
It kind of. He leads them into one of his famous dialogues, where he constantly shows that people don't know what they're talking about.
How much would you give to have seen that?
I would give a lot if I knew Greek.
See it and understand it.
Quite a lot. That, you know, when you get as far into the wine as we are now and start talking about, like, historical moments you'd like to see, I most likely pick the trial of Socrates and to be able to understand it. There's probably some other things I might pick too. But.
Yeah, just to, I mean, of everything we've talked about and everything you know about him, to actually witness him do that thing that he does, yeah, that would be pretty darn interesting.
Yeah, and I'm already a big fan of debates, so yeah, that would be pretty amazing. Kind of Socrates in his prime, arguing for his life, basically.
And in his prime, he's 70.
Yeah, but
he's had lots of time to practice.
So a lot of my books and stuff are in storage right now because I'm in a smaller place. So I couldn't find the original copy of the Apology, which is Plato's supposed transcription of Socrates' trial from beginning to end.
I did listen to a couple snippets of that this morning because I just found an audio version. And not knowing much about it, it was just kind of hard to get through. But yeah, so I'm a little bit familiar with at least the introduction of that.
Mm-hmm. It's I found a couple of free ones online, and the translations weren't great because it is all in ancient Greek, which is why I kind of wanted to find my first one, because the phrase we've been exchanging, the unexamined life is not worth living, I know that I know nothing, all that stuff is mostly from the Apology, and there are some great little pull quotes in there that you could geek out about if you like this kind of thing. It is, if you can get a good translation, it is a very beautiful story, and it's very short. It's only like a couple dozen pages or so.
One of my favorite kind of anecdotes that I came across in my research was somebody calling him out for saying, "You're saying the same thing you said before, and you've been saying for a long time." And he said, "Yeah, it's true, but it's more embarrassing that I keep saying it to the same people."
Yeah.
Which I thought was pretty clever.
Exactly. So, yeah, he starts... Yeah, like, Athenian courts were somewhat similar. Like, there was a jury that would kind of decide on sentencing. There was a prosecution and defense. The jury would hear both sides. And, yeah, here comes Socrates swinging out the gate, putting his prosecutors on trial, basically, and questioning them and getting them into these dialogues. And it becomes very obvious Socrates knows what's happening. He knows they are trying, in not so many words, to try him with atheism. He knows that people assume that he's a sophist and that he's like the fictional depiction of himself in the clouds. He's smart. He knows what he's up against aren't really the charges, it's the public perception of himself, because those are the people that are in the jury right now.
And it doesn't seem like he's not trying to save himself.
Not really, no.
He's more so sticking to the points that he's trying to make about society.
I think that, because a lot of the times you hear that, and you hear later in the apology that his daemon specifically told him, don't get into politics, don't do this, it will not go well for you. And I think that he kind of knew that if he ever got in this position, that was it. He wasn't going to backtrack. He wasn't going to play nice. He wasn't going to let this kind of thing stand.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to call these people out like he always does, and it was going to look really bad. And you can kind of, you get that kind of tenor throughout it that he is, maybe that's why it makes it so beautiful, because this is the last time he's going to argue against people.
At least it happened when he was 70 and not 30.
That's a good point. Yeah. So yeah, he knows this is a kind of witch hunt. This isn't really motivated by a real crime he's committed. This is about public perception, about politics, about he's pissed off very powerful people.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, to damaging to his reputation, you remember that guy Critias, who was the leader of the 30 tyrants?
Yep.
He was one of Socrates' students.
Oh, wow.
So he already is associated with some people that Athenians really don't like.
Is Plato in there as well at this point?
Yeah, he is in the trial as well. He is. Yeah. You'll see him later when he offers to help pay a fine when they realize Socrates doesn't have any money to pay a fine with.
Of course.
And, yeah, purportedly taking notes or something as this is happening. As well as several of Socrates' other students.
So Plato is part of the new wave of let's write shit down.
Yeah, despite not liking it, despite still being an old tradition, he was a prolific writer, which would, yeah, continue with the later philosophers that come after Socrates. Probably because there was so much discussion happening and so many new theories that people couldn't remember them all.
No, of course not.
And you start having schools like the academy and stuff like that. We had to pass knowledge down to large groups of people and make sure they're all getting the same thing. So maybe that helped. So
this is a witch hunt.
It is. He also has this friend, Alcibiades, who is an Athenian general who really waffled between being loyal to Sparta and Athens, and like Socrates apparently saved his life in the Peloponnesian War. They're very close. In a couple dialogues, it is implied that they might have been lovers.
Hmm.
So he is close to some people that Athenians don't like. So he is guilty by association. People don't like him. Powerful people don't like him. And so he lays into the chief prosecutor, Meletus, and gets him to admit, like he always does, that he doesn't really know what he's talking about. He shows that, look, you're trying to say I don't believe in the gods of the state, but you also accuse me of believing new gods, which you think is this demon, which has to be an emanation of the gods. So clearly I do believe in the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And he recounts that story of the oracle, saying, I'm like this way because of a message from the gods. Clearly I have to believe in them. He shows that he hasn't tried to do, unlike Lycon, get anything for his teachings. The greatest, I can't remember the quote exactly, but the greatest evidence he has about his innocence is his poverty. He's poor. He doesn't have a lot. He is there in dirty robes. He doesn't have shoes. He doesn't do this for personal gain, because he has to, because the gods told him. in not so many words. And the final charge, these corrupting youth, all the people he's taught are there, and relatives of them are there. And he goes into the stands and says, "You, were you offended? Did I corrupt your son at all? Has this become problematic, or has your life been enriched because you're questioning things?" And no one comes forward. Miletus has no witnesses. And so, by all accounts, he kind of shows he's innocent. And it's not as cut and dry as I described it.
Mm-hmm.
But
ultimately, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter because he's being a sophist. He is showing off. And I think that's kind of unambiguous in the apology, that he is showing up people who a lot of Athenians might consider his betters at this point. These are powerful, rich people who they think exhibit all the right virtues.
So they come to a decision on his guilt. I mean, and this is based on a vote.
Yes, it is. And it's not, I think I'm right in saying, it's not an overwhelming majority.
Yeah, I can't remember the numbers, but it was something like, 230-something versus 270-something. Like, it was not a big difference. Huge. But he, he's found guilty.
Yeah.
Of what, all charges, I guess?
I believe so, yeah. And so, when it comes to sentencing, instead of a recommendation from a judge or something, the defense and prosecution can make recommendations of what they think they deserve. And then the jurors come to a decision based on precedent. And so this is the real rub. So he's guilty of some very serious crimes that people have been put to death for in the past. And so they come to him and say, "Okay, you're guilty. What do you think your punishment should be?" And he says, "Well, considering all the good I've done you by showing you how ignorant you all are..."
Oh, I remember this.
"I think you should all give me free meals." specifically at this place where it's basically like very, very... people who have helped Athens a lot or people who have like competed in the Olympiad get to go to this place and get free meals every day.
So like mostly he's just hungry.
Yeah, but he is basically coming out and says, "I deserve to be rewarded, not punished." And rewarded in kind of in a very extravagant way.
He knows he's going down, so he's just going for it at this point.
And he still very much believes, like, "I am doing Athens a favor by being this annoying. I am showing ignorance. I am teaching people to love the virtues by loving philosophy."
Yeah, it's not going to do society any good for people to go on thinking that they know everything.
Exactly. So that doesn't play well, as you'd imagine. And so then he suggests, okay, a very, very kind of a... I think it's kind of a light fine. I had a hard time. It's 100 drachmae. Which is either quite a lot or not very much at all, depending on the source.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a couple $1,000s probably in today's money.
Mm-hmm.
And then, hastily, Plato and his other students say, "Stop, please. We can pay a fine. We can get a bunch of money together." And they propose about 3,000 drachmae, which is a bit more reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But the jury goes off. They've heard enough. This guy clearly isn't repentant. He clearly might even be crazy because he doesn't seem to know how much trouble he's in. They come back, I think it's a much stronger majority this time, that he needs to be put to death. Which, popularly at this time, is to drink a potion or like a mixture of hemlock, a soup stuff. This is the wine talking now.
I know. I actually kind of want to, like, Wikipedia what hemlock is about. I mean, obviously we know hemlock is a tree. But is it the leaves or poisonous hemlock?
I think it's the leaves. It's a specific variety of hemlock. A
highly poisonous biennial plant, herbaceous flowering plant.
In
the carrot family. Interesting.
Well, from what I've heard, it's not a terrible way to go. You just kind of go to sleep. But so, yeah, this is... He is sentenced to die by drinking hemlock, which is something they've even charged other philosophers like this before in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes to the holding cell and gets ready to die with his friends near him.
And like his followers and his friends are still trying to potentially save him.
Oh yeah, they are not
convince him to get out of it.
They are really unhappy with this course of action.
Yeah.
They tell him, look, we can bribe the guards. We can get you out of here. This doesn't have to be a death sentence. You can go to Crete or somewhere. Like, you can still keep doing what you're doing. This is crazy that you're deciding to die here.
But yeah, Socrates is just like, this is the way it has to be.
Exactly. Well, and he was a very patriotic person. He really loved the city he grew up and lived in. Like, he thought it was unjust to live so long under the protection and laws of Athens and then break them when it was convenient for himself. And justice is one of these virtues that he was striving to emulate. So,
it's kind of as annoying as he is, he's still a virtuous guy.
I mean, I'd say so, but I mean, I'd like to imagine that I am quite willing to admit when I don't know something. And that's primarily because of Socrates and him being kind of a philosopher's philosopher. Like, he did what he did to the grave, despite the fact that he knew it was going to kill him. Like, philosophy, I think, if you spend time studying it, what I found was that it's eventually you can break it down to a never-ending series of questions.
Yeah.
You're always going to be asking the same question, and there are lots of really good answers out there.
Philosophy and theory.
Yeah.
It's not about finding the answers. It's about raising more questions.
It is, but at some point it's finding an answer you're comfortable with, or an answer you think means something to you. Eventually, you do have to stop asking questions and say, okay, well,
finding
I think
a place
it's about
you
this.
Can... I mean, and this gets into Socrates, too. I mean, how should a person live? And finding the place where you're comfortable being, or you can live with yourself.
Exactly.
So, yeah. I guess that's where he was.
Yeah, definitely.
And I just want to make an art history note. if you're interested in seeing a depiction of the moment, The Death of Socrates by Jacques-Louis David is a great painting by the French painter. Him, you know, surrounded by his followers, basically weeping into their hands while he's holding the cup of hemlock very dramatically.
It's very emotional.
Yeah.
Who was it? Was it Raphael that painted the School of Athens?
Raphael painted the School of Athens, which is in the Vatican Museum.
I've seen five. It. Oh my God, really?
It's amazing.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm so jealous.
It was one of my favorite
room,
I saw in Rome. I mean, like, the Sistine Chapel, of course, is amazing. Yeah, but for me, there was just something about the School of Athens. And the two guys in the middle, I believe, are Aristotle and Plato.
It is.
But Socrates is there. He's very close to them. He's sort of off to the side.
Yeah. It's a weird mix.
It's a whole bunch of philosophers and...
That...
Michelangelo's in there somewhere. Yeah. And, it's
weird. That image of Plato motioning to the sky and Aristotle motioning to the ground, that is...
I thought it was the other way around.
Yeah, Plato's at the sky, Aristotle's at the ground. Because Plato believed in the forms and idealism. Aristotle believed in biology, logic.
That
this is where
sense.
We live.
Yeah.
And that is... as someone who studied a lot of religious studies, I'm fascinated by religion. That is the debate.
Yeah.
You either think that we are emanations from a more perfect thing, that reality isn't this, that it's something else, or you think it's all down here. And there's not a more beautiful, perfect illustration of that first dividing question of humanity than that painting of two men motioning in two different directions. I love it. I absolutely love it.
It was pretty great to see in person.
I imagine.
But yeah, let's not go down that rabbit hole.
All right. Back to
of course
sad
my,
things.
My inclination is to be like, can't it be both?
Yeah, you're right. We shouldn't
rabbit
go down
hole.
This hole.
Rabbit hole. But yeah, so Socrates, he chooses to drink the hemlock. And
he drinks the hemlock.
He does that and he dies. But because of that...
So he self-prophesies this whole following of events during his trial. He says, if you kill me, if you make me do this, you are not going to be rid of me. Because there are going to be hundreds more like me because you will make an example of how right I am in doing this. And he's right. Plato becomes an incredibly prolific philosopher, sets up his own school, has very stern things to say about democracy, writes the Republic.
I mean, in this, really sort of with Socrates and Plato, is a jumping off point for what we now call, like, Western thought and philosophy.
Very much so, yeah. So after Plato, one of his most famous students is Aristotle, who founds most of the basis of things like biology and logic.
But on a side note, doesn't think women have the ability to reason.
Yeah, he wasn't... Aristotle wasn't great for a lot of reasons.
Good but in some ways, not in others.
Very much so. Yeah, there is a kind of explosion of philosophical thought soon after Socrates dies in Athens, all across Greece. And a lot of these schools try to trace their history back to Socrates. They try to legitimize their claims by saying this is what Socrates was talking about.
Hmm.
So from here you get the skeptics. You get Stoics. You get Epicureans. You get Cynics. You guys, as I said, Plato and his works much later on start getting gobbled up by Christian theologians trying to wrap their heads around God.
And Plato is the one who comes up with the Socratic method? Is he the one that coins that?
That's a good question.
I think I did come across that in a couple of...
I'd imagine so?
In a couple of his readings, because he kind of uses Socrates' name at that point to sort of
draw
attention to his teachings or kind of speak with them.
So, yeah, like we said before, what most of what we know from Socrates comes from people like Plato or kind of his unofficial biographers. And very quickly, you notice that if you're reading through Plato's dialogues, the Socrates in those isn't the same Socrates as the earlier stuff. It's not the same Socrates from the trial. It's Plato's version of Socrates, who's still using the same kind of argumentative method to trick sometimes fictional people, sometimes real-world people, into realizing they either agree with them or that these popular-held notions are false, and that his notions, which Plato thinks is the ideals, the forms, that everything that exists is a imperfect copy of something that is ideal and kind of floats above us in the same realm as the gods. But yeah, everyone kind of starts to use Socrates' name to validate their new way of thinking. And it's incredible ways of thinking. It's mostly about... And again, it's mostly about leading the good life. Of trying. They characterize it in this Hellenistic period as being free from anxiety. A condition they call ataraxia, I think.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, the major ideas, which we already kind of talked about, you know, examine yourself, you know, look inwards, knowledge leads to virtue, leads to happiness.
Exactly. And they just have very different conceptions of how you come about knowledge and what that happiness looks like.
Yeah. It's funny because, I mean, everything I learned from Bill and Ted's tells me that Socrates was like a pretty laid-back guy. But, you know, maybe they weren't quite right on that.
Mm.
Or maybe they were, because that guy seemed pretty happy.
He drank wine like the best of them.
Mm-hmm.
Much like we were doing now. He liked to debate, and Greeks often like to debate topics while drinking diluted wine, because apparently their wine was very strong.
So when I was trying to name the podcast, you had suggested Symposium to me, which I couldn't quite make work, but I loved the idea of it because it's, you know, drinking and talking and arguing and
exactly.
Yeah. So basically this podcast is my symposium.
Totally.
So thanks for being on it.
Thank
is there
you
anything very much. Else we feel like is really important to talk about Socrates before we sign off?
I have this pet theory.
Okay,
sort
let's
of,
hear it.
But which probably isn't my theory. I'm probably lifting it from someone else that I forgot about. But studying a lot of religious figures and different traditions, you start to, at least I started to find that when you have new religions, there is a kind of setup you can kind of see coming, where there is social, cultural, economic instability. There is shifting religious traditions, or maybe a kind of crisis of different traditions.
There's a bunch of people fed up, I would assume.
Exactly. There's often very oppressed groups that are underrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this figure that comes around and kind of revolutionizes things. So you have Jesus with his particular take on the Old Testament, which is very different. You have Muhammad kind of retelling most of the Abrahamic face and making it about a different group of people and giving them a kind of way forward. You have Buddhism, which kind of arrives in a very hodgepodge of different religious traditions, all kind of straining for the same thing and pulling in very different directions. You have the various New Age movements that kind of grew out of the 60s in very political, tumultuous times, people looking for a different way to live. So I always kind of imagined Socrates kind of explaining why he became so popular, that he was almost a new religious figure, in that he, if you look at the nitty-gritty, he didn't really conceive of the gods the same way as most people did. He was a very controversial figure at a time. There was a lot of political and social uncertainty where people were in a position to start questioning the gods, and as we see right after, this huge explosion of thought, which...
It does seem like timing had a lot to do with it.
Yeah. And you also often see that when the religious figure dies, there's a lot of uncertainty, and you have these different groups of thought start to spring up when people start arguing about what the real meaning was, often very immediately after the fact. So that was always a, I always find it helps illustrate how he's important, where he was, I feel like we're just like a hop, skip, and a jump from this new, interesting Greek religion.
Very cool. Well, like I said, I didn't know a lot about it before we started researching it and talking about it, so thanks. Thanks again for bringing it to the podcast.
Thank you.
So, also, you are a writer, so I don't know if you wanted to...
Unfortunately, I am, yes. yeah, I have various projects on the go, but the one I am going to be relying on for regular work is my Patreon page, where you can look at different stories and poems I've written. I do short stories, I do, like I said, poems, I'll probably do essays and stuff like that in the future. And you can find that on patreon.com/notwriting, which I'm very happy I managed to get that name, but apparently no one else gets the joke. but yeah, you can look at what I've written there, you can donate and see stuff early, or you can see special behind-the-scenes stuff of how the... how writing gets written, which I think is really interesting.
Very much so. I definitely enjoy everything you write for our D&D campaign.
Thank you. That's mostly because I know you like Star Trek, so I try to formulate things in that way.
That helps. Okay, awesome. Well, thanks again, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up our episode for today. I hope you guys learned a lot. If you're interested in the wine that we talked about, it was Wise Owl Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand, and I really enjoyed it. Would totally get it again. Thanks again for joining us, and if you would like to contact us, the email is thetipsyarchives@gmail.com.